Vita Voices and Views is brought to you by Vita, Women in the Literary Arts, with host and executive producer Melissa Studdard and executive producer digital media R.J. Jeffries.
Critics have called Cheryl Strayed's work both a literary and human triumph. They've proclaimed that we need her and lauded how fiercely and elegantly she conveys truth. To read her is to agree. Strayed is the author of the number one New York Times best-selling memoir, Wild, and the novel Torch, books celebrated for transforming suffering and loss into power and grace. As well, Strayed is the author of two more New York Times bestsellers, Tiny Beautiful Things, which is comprised of advice from her Dear Sugar column, and Brave Enough, a collection of her most popular quotes. Strayed's books have been translated into 40 languages, and Wild was made into an Oscar-nominated movie starring Reese Witherspoon and Laura Dern, as well as being chosen by Oprah Winfrey as the first selection for Oprah's Book Club 2.0. In addition to writing, Strayed is the co-host of the WBUR podcast Dear Sugar Radio, which originated with her Dear Sugar advice column on the Rumpus, and she is a longtime feminist activist and one of the first members of Vita's board of directors.
Hi, Cheryl. Welcome to Vita Voices and Views.
Hi, Melissa. It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's wonderful to have you. It's my pleasure. I was actually about to say welcome home or welcome back because you were on the original board of directors for Vita, were you not?
Yes, indeed.
Yeah. Would you tell us a little bit about your history with Vita?
Oh, I have such a history with Vita. You're right that I was on that original board of directors. And before that, I was sort of there on the very ground level. I got that sort of now infamous message from Kate Marvin and read that post that she made on Facebook about being angered by this panel that she had proposed for AWP 1 year, featuring so many great women poets. And she felt like part of the reason that she'd been rejected was that the subject matter was female poets. And she put out this call, essentially, to writers all over the nation saying, am I alone in this? Or am I crazy? You know, am I the only one who notices things like, you know, you see all of those bylines in the New Yorker or the Paris Review or, you know, the sort of journals of the day. And so many of them are exclusively male or almost, you know, there's the rare women among them. And what was so powerful was to see how many women writers said, yes, me too. I feel this way too. And so Kate sent me a message and said, I would love to start an organization. And she partnered with Erin Ballou and she invited me to be, you know, somebody who started to really organize people and organize, especially nonfiction and fiction writers who might want to be part of this organization. Mm-hmm. And one thing led to the other and we formed Vita and I was on the board of directors for like, gosh, you know, 3 or 4 years. And it was a really powerful time to be right there when we were doing things like that first Vita count, which, you know, has become this annual thing that people in the lit world really look to.
Yeah, and look forward to.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So even when I finished my tenure on the board, which really coincided with these last few years since Wild came out in 2012, I just got so busy with my own writing life and you know, all the lives that we all have that I sort of stepped down, but I always feel like I'm part of Vita no matter what.
Yeah, I think Vita feels that way about you too.
Yeah,
Vita loves you.
Thank you.
So I know also you were involved in a lot of other feminist organizations and you started getting interested in feminism and becoming a feminist in college, if I'm correct.
Yeah, you know, actually before that, when I was a kid and I learned that word feminism, when I was, gosh, I was like 6 or 7 and I've been a feminist ever since. Mm-hmm. And when I was in college, of course, that really ramped up because before that I didn't have any community. I didn't have any support. My mom was a feminist, but, you know, it was something that was more like who we were rather than it being any kind of activism that we did. But when I went to college, like many people, what happened is I found my tribe. And one of the most important tribes of my life was that feminist tribe. I took a class in women's studies, and it utterly just like blew my mind.
Wow.
You know that, have you taken women's studies classes?
I have, and it did the same thing for me.
Yeah.
It just completely opened me up.
Yes. And, you know, for me, and I became a women's studies major. I have a bachelor's degree. I was a double major in women's studies and English with a focus on creative writing. And for me, it was really, you know, such a powerful time in my life to, it wasn't, I was learning new things. I was learning things about other people in the world and thinking about feminism in a far more kind of intersectional way and far diverse way, thinking about race, class, and gender, and how they intersected. So a lot of it was kind of new and awakening, but a lot of it was also simply me saying, yes, I knew that all along. I always thought that, but I thought I was alone. Mm-hmm. So it was, it's, part of it was just simply somebody finally telling my story.
That's amazing. I love that. You know, one of the things that I think it was from your Dear Sugar column. I've been so immersed in your work for the past few weeks and months, really, that it, sometimes it's hard to remember exactly where it came from. But I think it's from Tiny Beautiful Things. You were giving advice to someone, and you told a story about when you were working with these girls who were at risk. And it was just the most amazing thing. I mean, it has just like gotten into my core in a way that, you know, what you were originally telling the girls was that, don't worry, I'm calling the authorities, someone will come and help you, right? And then after a while of making the calls and making the calls, you realized that no one was coming to help, right? So you said that you changed the advice that you were giving them, and you told them basically, nobody is going to help you through this. You have to learn how to survive this. You have to learn how to get through it. And basically that you have to be strong. And I think that is just some of the most amazing advice I have ever heard. In fact, I think it may be the best advice I've ever heard, which is one of the reasons you're Dear Sugar, right? But I wanted to ask you to talk a little bit about how you came to that and also the work that you did with those girls, because I think that's just incredible.
Yeah. Yeah. And I want to just back up because, you know, so when I did the work with the girls, I worked for, it was a nonprofit organization called the Boys and Girls Aid Society here in Portland, Oregon, where I live. But my first jobs out of college were with nonprofits. I worked for the Abortion Rights Council of Minnesota, which is now Minnesota NARA. And I worked for a feminist peace organization called Women Against Military Madness.
That's awesome.
And it was this, you know, it really was, it was founded with the idea of, you know, an anti-militarization organization, a peace group with a feminist consciousness by all of these incredibly cool older women who were just fed up with, you know, all of the stuff that was happening in the 70s and 80s around, you know, nuclear armament and so forth. And by the time I was an organizer with them, we were still working on peace issues, but we were also working on treaty, Native American treaty rights and racism awareness and really kind of, you know, delving into all those areas that feminism has now, you know, become articulate in. And I remember being struck way back then, you know, when I worked for the Abortion Rights Council of Minnesota and when I worked for WAM, it was so much about basically women helping each other, women helping themselves. And then, you know, throughout my life, what I've seen in my own life and what I've seen in the lives I've, you know, the friends, male and female alike, who have had to essentially confront some suffering or confront some injustice that is, you know, whether it be a grand societal injustice like racism or whether it be a personal individual injustice like having, you know, a mother who's abusive or a father who's incarcerated, that ultimately, obviously, we need support from all these different places.
Right.
We need help, we need laws, we need, you know, all that. But also, but really at the end of the day, what I realized is that the people who had transformed their lives the most powerfully were people who came to that realization that work could only be done by them. That work could only be done by them. And So when I told those girls, okay, I'll try to help you and I'll try to report this to the police and I'll try to call this agency, you know, and found that essentially my efforts were futile. What I thought is, you know, I think it's striking that you say that's the best advice you've ever heard.
It is, truly.
Thank you. And I think what that means, what it means to me is that it's the truest advice. Mm-hmm. That really, as you know, probably mm-hmm. in your own life, I don't know you well at all, but I'm going to guess that like everything important that really happened when it came to how you changed the trajectory of your life or healed mm-hmm. the things you needed to heal, it was about you deciding that you were going to do that work mm-hmm. and you deciding that you were going to make choices that allowed mm-hmm. you to get where you are today. And, you know, I always sort of joke, it's like a kind feminist pull yourself up by your bootstraps.
Right.
And I don't mean it like, in any way, like it's your fault that you have to, you know, fix these consequences. What I mean it like is, in the end, the most powerful thing all of us can do is make our lives, you know, create our own lives.
Mm-hmm. That's wonderful. And, you know, just everything that you just said really exemplifies a lot of what I've been thinking about you and why I think what's really amazing about a lot of your writing and your column and your fiction, your nonfiction, all of it is that you do have this combination of a kind of toughness, but it's also like this, I think I've heard you call it before, like a radical sincerity and a radical compassion. I'm calling it radical compassion. You called it radical sincerity. And it's really an amazing and interesting sort of unique combination. I mean, to oversimplify it, you know, we would call it tough love, right? Right? Which is what I think a lot of people need to hear. And I think it's been one of the things that really set Dear Sugar apart. Because for anybody who's watching this who isn't familiar with that column, you know, the thing that was kind of extraordinary about it was that it came along into the genre of advice columns and sort of just turned that up on its head by being real, being sincere, being an actual person giving advice who talked about your own life, right? And I remember watching a speech that you were giving. I think it was... I'm trying to remember what it was exactly. I'm not quite sure, but you were talking about how when you first started the column, you felt like it was a little bit of a hipster scene and maybe you were supposed to be kind of clever with your advice. And you said, this is me. I'm sincere. This is who I have to be.
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
No, that's really true. I mean, I really began writing that column thinking, okay, it's all the hipsters of San Francisco, you know, that's where the Ruffus was founded. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there was it was definitely like a kind of hip vibe. There still is a hip vibe. And I just wondered, how can I fit in here? Right. Because really a hallmark of my work all throughout my life has been this sincerity thing,
mm-hmm.
Has been that sense of a heart-generated narrative,
mm-hmm.
which sounds... like terrible, you know. I mean, one of the things that I always wanted to do in my work is to risk sentiment.
Yes.
And you know, I'm 47. I came up in a literary generation mm-hmm. that recoiled at sentiment and that said, you know, it's the kind of like the postmodern ironic detached stance, the snark. And I admire some of those writers. You know, I don't have an aesthetic critique against those writers, but I am not one of those writers.
Right, right. I feel the same way.
I never wanted to be. I could never fake it. And one of the things I really believe as a writer is that you can't fake it. As mm-hmm. Sugar says, you can't fake the core. And I think that writing comes out of the core.
Mm-hmm.
And we write out of whatever, you know, that sort of deepest, truest place is within us. And for whatever reason, for me, it is work that does tend to be, you know, emotional. Mm-hmm. This isn't to say it's not restrained. You know, I don't aspire to be like, you know, the sort of Hallmark Channel of you know, like a sort of melodrama. What I aspire mm-hmm. to be, though, is to actually tell stories that are about our emotional lives. Mm-hmm. And so in some ways, Sugar was such a great conduit for that. I didn't realize that until later, until I was writing it. But, you know, here, these letters I was getting, these letters mm-hmm. I was responding to, they were really people's sorrows. I mean, people were writing to me with their troubles. That's what people write to advice columnists for.
Right.
And it was really the perfect venue for the sort of writer I am, I think.
Yeah. Well, you know, I noticed it in Torch as well, though. One of the things that I was surprised. I was really just caught off guard by how much I loved Torch, actually.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And not because, you know, I didn't love everything else that you've read, but it was the first thing of yours that I read, actually. So yeah. I just, you know, and I had been reading poetry almost exclusively for years and years. And then I picked up this book of fiction and I thought, oh, you know, sort of muddle through this. And then I was just riveted by it. And
thank you.
You're welcome. And, you know, one of the things just along with what we're talking about is you have this ability to create these characters which are so incredibly complex. And it's not, I mean, the sincerity, I know what you're talking about with the sincerity and it, the way it is perceived in this climate right now, this current literary climate is that it's just not cool or whatever. But I think that, you know, you talk about writing from the core, there's this like fundamental sense of who these people are that you can't get if you're being too clever or too sincere. It's like this right balance. And I'm thinking in particular of the grandparents in that story, because you can't hate anyone in the story. There's so much compassion for everyone that even when you're told all these bad things that they've done, you know, like the grandparents call and make the mother cry, they upset her, they don't help her financially when she needs it, they do all these things, and you're reading this and then all of a sudden there's this zinger line of, and they were the only people who would die for her, or they were the people who would die for her. So I wanted to ask you, I'm not really quite sure exactly what my question is, but about creating that kind of a character. I mean, what is it, do you come to, you know, your writing and say, I want to create a character that is just so like round and full that even when they do bad things, you have to love them.
Yeah. Absolutely. I just got tears in my eyes listening to you talk about that, because I wrote it so long ago. I mean, I wrote Torch, I mean, I guess not so long ago, but, you know, sort of like in the early 2000s. It was published in 2006, and I haven't read it for years, but I know it so intimately. When you started to talk about those grandparents, it all came back to me. And, you know, I'm so honored. I'm so thrilled and honored that you noticed that about those characters, because that is what I care about, both when I write fictional characters or when I write nonfiction where I'm a character or real people I know are characters, is that even the people who have done really bad things and who are not, you know, sort of behaving in ways that we hope everyone behaves or we have some judgment about, even with those people, I do find that, you know, both in real life and in literature, the fact of the matter is everyone has a point of view and a perspective, and that we can have some compassion for their position. And I think that this is what literature's job is, frankly, is to let us into the hearts and minds of people who we aren't. And sometimes we have an incredible affinity with those characters because they're just like us. You know, I meet so many people who have read Wild and they're like, you don't know it, Cheryl, but we're actually best friends.
Yeah.
So much in common. And, or the, you know, but I'm also flattered when we find the opposite, when people say things like you just said. So those grandparents, you know, you probably had compassion, right, as a single mother yourself, for this woman, this character who was being judged
definitely.
By her parents. And she had disappointed them. She'd gotten pregnant. She was supposed to be this good Catholic girl. And in this, you know, in the 60s, and she got pregnant out of wedlock and then had to marry the guy. That didn't work out. And they had all these judgments against her. But, and all of those judgments were true judgments that they had, and they were mean. Mm-hmm. But the baseline truth that lived between them was that they also loved her. Like that she was their daughter.
Yeah.
And I think that if I'm going to show one truth, mm-hmm. I'm going to also show the other truth, you know, and one of the things I love to do, and I love to witness when other writers do this too, is that idea. I think so much of life is about the ability to sort of hold two opposing yes. truths, you know, in your two hands.
Yes.
To say, it can be true that this person is this way and this way. And, you know, this comes up over and over again in the Dear Sugar column and now my podcast. You know, Steve Allman and I do the podcast together. We just recently did an episode on a series on sort of infidelity. Mm-hmm. And one of the letters we discussed, it was from this woman who'd had a baby. She and her husband had just had a baby. Mm-hmm. And she went away for a little bit, you know, a week or so with the baby. And while she comes home and while she was gone, she finds out that her husband has hired a prostitute and he's had sex with her in their bed.
Oh my gosh.
And I think that it's one of those things that most of us would go, what a terrible person. You know, what kind of monster would, like, you know, do this to his infant child and his wife?
Right.
And in their bed, you know, all of these layers of wrong. And yet what I also know to be true is that that man can absolutely love his wife and his daughter.
Mm-hmm.
And he can be somebody who failed in this moment of his life, and he can also be somebody who rises from that failure.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think that when we neglect to acknowledge those truths in our lives and in our artistic work as well, what we're doing is we're actually not doing that thing that art is supposed to do, which is tell the truth.
Mm-hmm.
Most people are complicated. Most people can be monsters and the most singular, you know, exceptional people, and they're one and the same. And so, yeah, I try to do that in all my characters. I try to reveal that about myself too when I write about myself, and that can be really tricky.
Yeah. Well, thank you. I think that's extraordinary, and it's beautiful in terms of literature because, like you said, it's also something that I look for when I read. I want that mm-hmm. complexity. I mean, I think of another, like a play that does that is A Raisin in the Sun, you know?
Yeah.
I've always loved that play so much, and that's kind of how I felt when I was reading this. But I think it also, in addition to what it does for us through literature, I think it helps us in our own lives, too, because we learn how to look at the people in our lives that way, too, and say, okay, what kind of complex thing is going on here? That,
right.
You know, with the person. So thank you. I wanted to say also another thing that I really liked, one more thing about Torch is, in addition to like the largeness of character and theme and everything, I just love what you do with figurative language. And you have actually a real gift for it in the sense that it's never like decorative. You have this way of using it so that it does what it's supposed to do, which is help us understand the subject matter better. And there was one part that really stood out to me, because I just want people watching this to have a feeling for like how rich the language is in your work. And what you said was acceptance. I'm not sure if I have the exact words right, but it was something along the lines of, acceptance was not what she imagined it would be. It was not a room or a field that she could run through. It was small and scroungy, and it was in constant need of repair.
Mm-hmm.
And I love the way you phrased that. And I wanted to ask you, I know it's probably has something to do with the way your mind works. You know, Jeff, who produces the show, who we were talking to earlier, he literally thinks in metaphors and analogies, and we're just having an everyday conversation, and he talks like that. He's not even writing. Is it that way for you? And what have you done to sort of cultivate that? Like, if somebody wanted to learn to do that?
That's really interesting. Because I actually do think it's the way my mind works. No, nobody's ever asked me about that. But, and maybe it's part of, like, I've always been terrible at math. I've had no interest in math. And when I try to do math, like, I just can't sustain, you know, any engagement with it. And part of it is because, to me, math is not a story.
But I feel the same way.
And same with, you know, if I could make a story, and there's a section in Wild too where I even say this, you know, when I'm lost, or rather I'm not sure exactly where I am because the snow is covering the trail. And I keep looking at the map and I say, you know, that what's helping me is a sense of like the story. If you walked by a lake 20 minutes ago and then there's a mountain northwest of you, are you in this place? Like I have to sort of make a story.
Right.
And just the other day I'm trying to figure out, like I've never in all my life understood like anything about the stock market or any kind of like how that works. Like
I'm with you.
If you put $100 into the stock market and then the stock market goes down, you know, people always talk about like they lost money or they made money. I'm like, but what does that mean? And so the only way I could understand it is I was asking somebody and I was like, so is it like, is there a hole in the bottom of the bucket? So if you pour water in and it goes out the bottom, or does the bucket hold the water no matter what happens to the stock market? What's funny to me, that made sense to me. Like, if you lose money, is it gone forever? Or do you still own those stocks? They're just not worth anything. So I had to put it in an image. And what was amazing is the answer is there's not a hole in the bottom of the bucket. Like even if you, and I was like, okay, finally. So if anyone wants me to explain the stock market to them, I can explain this whole bucket water thing.
We'll have to talk about it with buckets. That's really interesting.
It's because I need to be able to see it in a concrete way. And I also, you know, this is one of the things in my writing that I've always wanted to do. So I do think that I'm a pretty, I write realism.
Mm-hmm.
To me, I try to actually always create the sensation of a sense of, you know, that like these fictional characters are actually people, or mm-hmm. I'm alive on the page, or this is a real, you know, vivid world.
Yeah.
And but I do really try to use, I mean, I love poetry.
Mm-hmm.
And I love language.
Mm-hmm.
So even though I'm not like, you wouldn't call me like a sort of language writer, it's not as if I only use kind of, you know, plain language. I do try.
You absolutely don't.
It's full of figurative language, as you noted, you know. And it's part of, like, it just comes to me naturally. It's also what I think is beautiful about writing.
Yeah.
You know, I think that we get to do that stuff on the page. And so let's do it. You know, that's why, I mean, I love the sentence in another writer that I'm reading along and I have to stop and read it again.
Yes.
It's so pretty.
Yes.
Don't you love that?
I love it. Absolutely. You know, what's funny about what you just said too, is that I'm trying to think about how to like unpack this, but you used an analogy of an example about an analogy. Do you see what I'm saying? You gave me an analogy of an analogy to show me how your mind works in analogies. It's like, it's so deep. It's definitely the way your mind works.
That's exactly it.
It's amazing. Well, do you have anything with you that you can share with us that you can, as long as we're on the topic of your writing and your writing style?
Sure.
Which book?
I could read from... You know, now that you ask me about Torch, I really wish that I had grabbed Torch to read to you from that. But I want to say one of the most interesting experiences. So Torch was published in 2006.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, in 2012 is when Wild was published.
Right.
And Wild became, this bestseller. And so then they asked me they wanted to do an audiobook of Torch. And they wanted me to read it. And so I hadn't read Torch since I wrote it. Like, you know, maybe 7 years had gone by since I'd even read the book. Because, you know, you get to the point with your work where you're just like, I can't.
Right.
So I had to go into the studio. And when you read an audiobook, I mean, especially a book that long, you know, I'm there all week. And I'm reading my own book out loud. And not just out loud, but, you know, for the audio tape. So you have to be very... you know, performative and intentional.
Yeah.
And it was such an interesting experience because, of course, some years had passed. I'd become, you know, you always are developing. And there were so many things that I thought, okay, like I could see my younger self. I could see my younger writer self on the page, you know. And it was a kind of actually a sweet and beautiful thing that you can go back and, and see how you did this or that, grappled with this or that. So it was a really cool thing to visit it. And that's the last time I read the book, which is like 2012. So thank you for reminding me of it.
Oh, absolutely. And I have to say, I actually did listen to your audio recording of that book. And it was beautiful. I mean, I kept wondering, like, how can she read that long without messing up? Or, I mean, it never felt like you even, like, took a breath. I mean, I'm not saying that it didn't sound natural. It just sounded like you were at a reading, you know, reading to your family or, you know, a group of people. And it was, you did a beautiful job with that. I know it's not easy.
Thank you. That means a lot to me. I also did the audiobook for Tiny Beautiful Things.
Mm-hmm.
Same process. It was something else. I haven't listened to either one of them.
Oh, you should.
It's hard to sit there in a room and listen, not only to listen to your own writing, but to you reading it. It's just like, okay, you know, maybe not.
Right.
I'm going to read just this, I thought I'd read like just a brief passage from this. Hold on one second. How long do you want me to read? Like 2 minutes?
And anything under five is fine.
Yeah, just like a little smidge.
Yeah, two is perfect, actually.
What'd you say?
Two is perfect, actually.
Yeah. So I thought I'd read this from this section that ended up being a section that so many people have quoted back to me mm-hmm. and talked to me about, and it's in the movie, and a lot of people say it's a really important passage mm-hmm. to them. And the reason I grabbed it to read is that for me, I'll talk about it after I read it.
Okay,
I
want
to talk
perfect.
About how I came to write that passage and what it means to me as a writer. So what's happened in the book is I'm in the middle of my hike. I'm going to read from Wild.
Yeah.
I'm in the middle of this long 1,100-mile hike on my Pacific Crest Trail journey in the summer of 1995 when I was 26. And I had been, before I went on the trail, one of the things that happened is I had really been promiscuous in ways that ended up being kind of not good for me. I'm not against promiscuity. I think occasional, and I am glad that I did a lot of the stuff I did, but some of it ultimately was not good for me as a person.
Right.
And so I needed to kind of go through a sort of celibate period in my life just to kind of get back in my body.
Yeah.
And recalibrate my relationship to men. And but nonetheless, I go on this hike, and a couple months into it, I meet a man, and I end up, hooking up with him. And so we are together on this Oregon beach, and I walk away from him. I go on a little walk on the beach, and I got divorced a few months before. I want to walk a bit further, if you don't mind, I said to Jonathan, leaving my sandals near the blanket. It felt good to be alone, the wind in my hair, the sand soothing my feet as I walked down the beach. I collected pretty rocks that I wouldn't be able to take with me. When I'd gone so far that I couldn't make out Jonathan in the distance, Jonathan's the guy, the little boyfriend, I bent and wrote Paul's name in the sand, and Paul is my ex-husband. I'd done that so many times before. I'd done it for years, every time I visited a beach after I fell in love with Paul, when I was 19, whether we were together or not. But as I wrote his name now, I knew I was doing it for the last time. I didn't want to hurt for him anymore, to wonder whether in leaving him I'd made a mistake, to torment myself with all the ways that I'd wronged him. What if I forgave myself, I thought? What if I forgave myself even though I'd done something I shouldn't have? What if I was a liar and a cheat, and there was no excuse for what I'd done other than because it was what I wanted and needed to do? What if I was sorry, but if I could go back in time, I wouldn't do anything differently? What if I'd actually wanted to fuck every one of those men? What if heroin had taught me something? What if yes was the right answer instead of no? What if what made me do all those things everyone thought I shouldn't have done was also what had gotten me here? What if I was never redeemed? What if I already was? What if I already was? So.
Wow.
The reason I read that passage, you made me think of it actually when you were talking about this idea of the imperfect character being actually the perfect character. Like, you know, that it makes the character so much more interesting to us if we show the negative and the positive sides, you know?
Yeah.
And I think in so many ways, that was that real moment in my life that I documented in the book was kind of the first time that I deeply reconciled with my own self and said, you know, okay, I can't be just a good person, but that doesn't make me a bad person. And so that series of questions that I was finally allowing into my head, like, what if I did just forgive myself, even though I've done some things I shouldn't have done? And I think that that moment is a really revolutionary moment in our lives. Don't you?
I do. And I think that maybe by writing it, you are helping a lot of people get to that moment too, because I think, you know, I think I was much older than you were when I got to the point to where I could just say, maybe I should forgive myself. You know, it's not the easiest thing to do. I don't know why. I think a lot of people feel comfortable in the guilt or, you know, it's difficult. And that's a really, really wonderful passage.
I think that it's, when we forgive ourselves for the things we did wrong, in so many ways, what that's about is finally erasing, or at least attempting to negate the narrative that we've been given as girls and women, as men and boys, as people in the world. You know, here's the things you should do.
Right.
Here's the way you should be. And I really think that life and literature is not about should, and it's not, you know, what you're like. It's who you are really, you know, and who you are really is so much more complex and also interesting and beautiful than I think that those kind of more artificial sort of surfaces that we all kind of want to show the world.
Yeah, you know, it makes me think of the story that you told in the preface to Torch about how when you were in grade school, I think it was the assistant principal pulled you out because you had described, I think it was Philadelphia, as both filthy and beautiful.
Pittsburgh, yeah.
Pittsburgh, okay. So is that the right state?
Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
That's what I did. And, you know, it was my first and one of my last poems. But he acknowledged it. He said to me, wow, and here I was like this kid, you know, 9 or 10 or something. He's like, I never thought about that something could be both beautiful and filthy at the same time.
Yeah.
And see, I did.
Right.
And I've always thought that.
And that makes the world so much more bearable and more beautiful, really.
It does.
Because when you try to sanitize it, it doesn't work.
and it doesn't work because we don't believe it.
Right. True.
I always try to convince when I teach memoir, you know, the big fear about writing memoir is like, well, but if I, you know, will people judge me? Will people think about this or that? And I'm like, yeah, some people will. And most people will actually say thank you. Thank you for showing a version of yourself that feels true to me, because I'm that way too.
Yeah.
And I do think, like, nobody likes a braggart. Nobody likes somebody who's like, oh, no, not me. I'm perfect. Be like the person at the edge of the party who's going to say, yeah, you know, actually, I've had 4 miscarriages.
Right.
Or I am divorced.
Right.
Or I am in recovery because I used to be a drug addict. Or do you know what I mean? Like,
I know exactly what you mean. Yeah.
Like, okay, my people.
Right, exactly. I mean, I don't smoke anymore, but I used to smoke. And that's one of the reasons I used to always like to stand outside and talk to the smokers, because they were so human, you know.
They were the bad people.
Right. Well, I wanted to say, you know, as long as we're on Wild, another thing that I thought was really important about Wild is... I think anybody who's been through the American education system has had this list of like conflicts and themes that we're supposed to study, and that we were supposed to always look for things like man against man against nature, you know, but in Wild.
Always men.
right. So, you turned something upside down. You turned that upside down. And it's really twofold, I think, because not only does it change from man to woman, and it's in every woman. It's you, and it's memoir. It's not fiction, but it's still in every woman. But in addition to that, it takes out the against, communing. I mean, it's certainly not that it's easy, but it feels like you're finding a sort of home, like a true home in nature. And I think that's a really interesting thing that you did with the book. Was that an intentional feminist decision, or?
Well, it's interesting the way, my answer to that is a little complicated because I think every decision I make is informed by my feminism. Yeah. I mean, there's no separating me from my feminism.
Right.
It's informed me from the beginning. Same with my femaleness and my, fill in the blankness. My being a mom. Certain things enter you in a way that are so sort of central that you're always speaking from that place. And of course, there isn't just one place of feminism, as we know, right? There's not one place of femaleness, as we know.
Exactly.
I was aware of the fact that I was writing a narrative that was in a tradition that was man versus nature, that was about male domination of nature, and nature being a sort of feminine force. And I wasn't making big political decisions when it came to writing a narrative that was sort of that sort of answered to that in a sort of countering way, but all I had to do was step aside and tell the true story, which was, this is who I am, and this was my experience in the wild, and it wasn't about domination. It was about learning how to commune, how to live within the context of this environment, this wild world. And it was about returning home in a kind of metaphorical sense, of finding my place in the world, finding my sense of wholeness among the many, many, many whole living things.
Mm.
And what's so astounding out there is, I was alone so much, and I was always surrounded with the living world.
Mm-hmm.
When you actually decide to believe the truth, that every tree you encounter is actually a living being, it changes your perspective on what alone means.
Yeah.
And I know that we don't like to think that trees are living things because we sort of think of it as far out there, or it threatens our way of life, or it threatens our, our idea that we get to do whatever we want to do with a tree. But I really did develop that sort of consciousness out there I was more connected than I'd ever been. And I was also more alone than I'd ever been.
Wow. Again, it's the, like you were saying earlier, the two, holding the two things simultaneously true, that the paradox. Yeah. Wow.
Well,
that's really
interesting. My experience is so common. I mean, this is why many, many, many people love to go into nature.
Yeah.
I mean, whether it be that's why Central Park exists, it's because people and somebody along the way understood that this was important, that even in this big New York City, Manhattan, you need to go and sit next to a tree sometimes.
Yeah. I saw you made a post recently about a book that I actually want to read too, but I can't remember the name of it right now, about the trees, the German.
Yeah.
Do you remember the name of that book?
I'm forgetting the name of the book, but I want to tell you also about another book. So there's this German forester, has written about really the very complicated lives of trees that are far more sort of sophisticated than any of us would guess, that they can communicate with each other and so forth. And there's a memoir that's going to be published this spring by a writer named Hope Jaron. She's a scientist, and this is her first book. And it's called Lab Girl. And it's a great feminist book. It's about this, very accomplished woman who's a scientist, and she writes all about plants and trees and so forth in the book, and it's so illuminating and enlightening in ways. ways that I found just beautiful.
Mm, that sounds wonderful. I'll have to write that down in a minute. Yeah, I definitely want to read that. And I want to read the other one too. I love trees. So I'm totally with you on that. I wanted to tell you, I actually had kind of a funny experience with wild. What happened was I was driving and I was just starting to read wild and I was driving home from work and I started thinking about how I had seen an interview with you where you had talked about towards the end of Wild, how you had to sort of go off and be on your own when you were writing it and spend some time by yourself to finish writing it. And then I started thinking about that in connection to how you had gone off on your own to do the hike in the first place. And I started thinking about how this is a really powerful thing for especially a choice for a woman to make, just this choice of I'm going to be alone for a period of time for whatever reason. And I started thinking about Audrianne Rich and a story that I had heard about her when I was in graduate school, about how she said that as a woman, one of the most difficult things was just trying to get time to be alone. And she talked about how even as a young mother, she would just go to the bathroom to try to be alone, like literally go in and just sit on the toilet. And her kids would run in there and sit on her lap on the toilet. So the weird thing is I was thinking about all of this and I was thinking, oh, I have to remember to ask Cheryl about, you know, this idea of the power and sort of claiming the power to be alone. And then I came home and I started reading Wild again. I got to the end of the first chapter and it was a poem. You talked about a poem by Audrianne Rich called Power. And I was just like, whoa, it was one of those chills moments. So,
I carried that Audrianne book, Audrianne Rich book, The Dream of a Common Language. I carried it on my whole Pacific Crest Trail hike.
That's amazing. And that was, I know that some of the books you chose not to keep to, you know, trade or even burn. So why that one, you know, to keep with you the whole time?
Well, poets have been so important to me, but Audrianne Rich in particular during that time of my life. My friend Gretchen Legler, who's a memoirist and essayist, gave me The Dream of a Common Language right after my mom died. And I was a senior in college and about to graduate. And inside the book she wrote, this book has been a good friend to me. And it was a good friend to me, too.
Yeah.
There were poems in it that just made me feel like I wasn't alone. And I think that Audrianne Rich, you know, just wrote so deeply and rigorously into the truth of the, as she says, you know, the source of, you know, the greatest source essentially of your power is your wounds. And I think if there's one thing that if you could just like, if you had to say one thing about what I am as a writer or what I do as a writer, it's that.
Yeah,
that the greatest, you know, that out of our wounds, if we can get a sense of our own power, that's where our strength rises, you know. Yeah. And so that poem called Power, you know, it really was like, remember this, you know, even in the darkest times, even the times that you felt like you've lost something that will make you suffer forever, like when my mom died, you know, there's no question. That I felt that way, and I wasn't wrong about that. I mean, that's what's one of the most interesting things to me about losing my mom and the grief I felt. And I remember thinking, like, I will suffer forever because my mom died young, and I was right. I'm 47. My mom's been dead a long time. She's been dead longer in my life than she was alive in it. And I every day I miss my mom. But what I didn't know back then was that I could, you know, that it didn't have to harm me every day of my life. That it could be a sorrow that would also contain within it strength and joy and beauty and light. And so, you know, I think I carried Audrianne Rich with me because she was like a messenger from both the past and the future. And I intuitively knew that I had to have that book with me along the way.
That's great. And I like what you said about the inscription about the book being a good friend to her. And I did have that feeling when I was reading Wild, like in addition to the trees and the nature being your company. The books were your company too.
The that books, was a company. And books. Yeah. I think I even say this in Wild, like right out. I just say, you know, literature is my religion. Yeah. Books have been the thing throughout my life that it's offered the greatest consolation and enlightenment and illumination and all of the things that we go to, you know, to religion or spiritual practice for. Books have been that for me. Yeah. I know I'm not alone in that. A lot of writers feel that way.
That's beautiful. I feel that way too. So,
yeah, I know you do. I mean, that's what's so cool. It's like, I mean, I think writers always get this kind of bad rap, like, oh, we're just like so competitive and at each other's throat. And, you know, and I would say like, yeah, every once in a while there's somebody's like not cool or whatever. But mostly what I feel like is, no, we go to the same church, you know, and we speak that same language and we have the same values and beliefs in a sort of deep way. And I feel the presence of that. I mean, I love the sense of community among writers.
I love that. I love the way you said that. We go to the same church. That's perfect. going back to initially what I was saying, to contrast companionship, I do want to ask you about the choice that you've made at several times in your life to be alone, to go on the hike alone, to go away, to write Wild. It may seem like a small thing to some people, but it feels like a really radical and wonderful thing to me, because I think that we move through our lives feeling so much obligation that it's not even healthy sometimes, you know, and to have that, it speaks to a sort of internal, like sort of reserve of confidence or something to just be able to say, I need this time.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I've always had that. I'm such an extroverted person that I think that people sort of assume that I don't need that kind of solitude. I call myself an extroverted hermit. I get energy from being around people and talking to people, but I also am, you know, really, really, I need to be alone. Yeah. And this is why I was very concerned about having kids, because I always knew that I wanted to have that experience of motherhood. It just felt like, you know, a really big experience that I didn't want to miss out on. Mm-hmm. And I also always knew that, like, I really like to be alone. And also that so much of the important work in my life has to happen in solitude.
Yeah.
It has to happen in that very uninterrupted space. I am not a daily writer. Mm-hmm. I'm a binge writer. Mm-hmm. What that means is I go into these almost like, you know, like these mad periods of the kind of the mad artist who's working 14-hour days and then sleeping a little bit and working another 14-hour day. And that's really how I write best. And so how does that fit into life with a job? How does that fit into life with children in particular?
Yeah.
Very challenging. And, you know, so until I had kids, like, it was interesting. Like, sometimes people would sort of act like I was being selfish by going off alone, which I think is fascinating. I think it's fascinating that we say that that's selfish, because I have, there's nothing about that to me that seems selfish.
Mm-hmm.
But step back when you become a mother and you decide to go away. And this is the, I've been on the other end of that judgment a lot, you know, both, as you say, like what happened is, I had to go away to finish writing Wild. And what had happened is I'd sold Wild, like based on the first like 130 pages and which I'd written when my kids were toddlers, and somehow miraculously managed to get those pages out. And sold the book, and then it was due, you know, like 9 months later. And I was trying to write while taking care of the kids and doing all this teaching and doing all these other things like we do. And, you know, one kid would get the flu, and then the other kid would get the flu, and then I would get the flu. Like, I could never extract myself from, you know, my domestic motherly life.
Yeah.
And I said to my husband, I need to go. I have this chunk that I have to write, and I'll be done with the book. And he was so supportive. You know, I couldn't have done it if I were a single mother who didn't have a partner or didn't have a co-parent. I mean, I know some single mothers have great co-parents, and they can send the kids to that other parent. But I, you know, have a wonderful husband who was like, go do whatever you need to do. Mm-hmm. And the barrier for me was just my own fear of leaving my kids for 3 weeks.
Yeah.
I've never left them that long. That was one barrier. But then once I could step over that barrier, the other one was the judgment of other people, and specifically other mothers.
Yeah.
And I had to say, guess what? I love my kids every bit as much as any mother in the whole history of mothers has loved her children. And I also need to finish my book.
Right.
And when I left, I knew that what I had to do was give myself that time, mm-hmm. and not spend it obsessing over whether my kids were okay or whether they missed me or whether I was damaging them. I just went and I gave myself that time and I finished my book. And I don't regret it at all. What was so amazing, of course, I come home and my kids are like, hi, Mom, you know.
Like you've never even been gone.
Yeah. And then, you know, that's in the big career I've had since then, mm-hmm. you know, the years of being the ambassador around the world for a while. I've traveled a lot. I've taken my kids with me sometimes and other times I haven't. Mm-hmm. And I do get this kind of question that I think a lot of male counterparts who have kids wouldn't be asked.
Right.
You know, all about my kids. And sometimes it's curiosity from other mothers who are like, mm-hmm. how do you do it? And I don't fault that. Like, I understand that we need to tell each other how mm-hmm. to do it. And I told a lot of other mothers, like, you can leave your kids for a couple weeks and they're going to be okay. And I think mm-hmm. that's fine. Sometimes it's that question is asked from that kind of just really wanting to know space. Sometimes it's asked from that kind of judgmental space. Mm-hmm. Like, how dare you? You know, what kind of mother are you who would willingly do this? And my answer to that is I'm the kind of mother who loves her kids. Mm-hmm. And I get to be, because of all the sacrifices all the women who came before us made, we get to be different kinds of mothers. We get to redefine mm-hmm. what femininity means, what being a woman means, and what being a mother means. And that to me, like what I've chosen to do in terms of my independence and my solitude and my passion and commitment for my writing is not even remotely in contradiction to the amount that I give my kids and the amount my kids feel absolutely loved by me.
Mm, that's wonderful. It's actually one of the things I admire about you. I was kind of thinking while you were talking is that I think it's difficult sometimes to quiet the internalized voices of other people who are judging us.
Yeah.
And, you know, in the columns that you write and in Wild, I see too, this ability that you have to just sort of quiet those and hear the, like the true inner voice. Mm-hmm. Because I think so much of our lives are this pull back and forth between what we know is right, but then this outward construct telling us that something else is right. That's a hard, constant battle, you know? So
it is. And I think, too, you touch on something really interesting. I actually think it's also true that sometimes that voice of judgment, mm-hmm. we're almost, like, imposing it ourselves. Like, we mm-hmm. know what that kind of the voice is in the culture, and then nobody even needs to say it to us. Like, we're putting it on ourselves.
Exactly.
Will the other mothers judge me if I leave? Meanwhile, like, what mothers? Like, you know, it's like, I can't actually tell you, like, an example of a mother who thought I was a terrible person.
Right.
Child, you know, but I'm just like, imagine they're out there, you know? And so some of it is our own, as you know, right? Internalized
exactly.
sexism, internal, all that stuff we internalize actually has enormous power.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things I've tried to internalize is deeply this idea that part of my obligation, like, you know, part of my feminism
mm-hmm.
is about saying, you know, okay, I'm going to be rattled by this sometimes. I'm going to be rattled by the idea that I'm going to leave my kids for 3 weeks to finish my book, or, you know, not decide not to feel guilty about something.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's like the first time women in history have ever done that thing, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like we're used to it. This is the way we are used to, like, of course men go off and leave their kids when they need to do their work. Of
right.
course they do. You know, we don't take that to mean that they don't love their kids. And so we're still in this very complicated time where we're still not sure about women and children and their relationships to each other.
Exactly. And I mean, you didn't drop them off at an orphanage for three weeks. They were with their other parent. So Right.
Exactly.
Well, I see we're actually running out of time, so I wanted to ask you
to talk about, but
I know I have so many more questions for you. Like I wrote out a bunch of questions and I put the ones that I really, really wanted to ask you in red instead of black so that I would make sure I got to those ones. And I still have like five of those that I haven't gotten to.
I babbled on too much.
No, absolutely not. It's been a real pleasure. I did want to ask you though in closing about what you're working on now and what's next for you.
What's next for me? Well, right now I'm in the midst of writing a pilot with my husband, Brian Lindstrom. We're writing it together. We have a development deal with HBO for a TV show based on my Dear Sugar book, Tiny Beautiful Things. And Laura Dern and Reese Witherspoon and their producing partners, Jamie Lemons and Bruno Papandrea, are all involved in the project as well.
Wonderful.
As producers. We all, I had so much fun working with Laura and Reese on the movie Wild.
Yeah.
That we became friends and we were like, let's do another project together. And they were, really, they were big fans of Tiny Beautiful Things. And I'd always thought it could be used as a premise for a TV show, this idea of this character who isn't going to be me, but she has a lot in common with me. A woman in her 40s who lives in Portland and writes this anonymous advice column. And it's very at the beginning. TV is a weird world. It's at this point, who knows if it will ever, when you'll see it or how, but we're writing the pilot right now, my husband and I. That's the big project of the moment.
That's exciting. I know you have a lot of fans of that. And I wanted to mention also, we haven't really talked about it, but you had the new book, Brave Enough, which I have behind me, come out, which is, it has a lot of quotes from Tiny Beautiful Things and from all of your writings.
Yeah.
And I thought that was interesting the way that came about. That was basically crowdsourced, wasn't it?
It was.
Yeah.
It's kind of an interesting book because it is this book that it was, my publisher had the idea because they were seeing all these people online, tweeting and making memes and so forth. And I was getting pictures emailed to me of like tattoos, be like, how loud is to let it be?
That must feel so weird and wonderful.
It's so flattering. I mean, really so flattering. But so the idea was that that it would be fun to sort of collect these. I'm such a lover of quotes. And as you see, you noted like in Wild, I quote Audrey Rich and Joni Mitchell and, James Michener and all of these people in my books. And so I just thought it was sort of a fun book to put together. And I didn't choose like, the idea wasn't like, let me see how wise I am. I will choose my quotes. But the quotes that other people thought were useful or compelling. So I looked on social media, I looked on Pinterest, I looked on these places where you find quotes, and that's how those quotes got chosen.
Well, I have to say that's one of the things I really love about Sugar, too, is that you never come across like, oh, I'm so wise, let me tell everybody what to do. It's more like, well, I'm a person, and here's my perspective, and, it's really, that's one of the reasons people love Sugar, I think.
Thank you.
Yeah. And I also like what you said about how the quotes that we love, speaking of people tattooing it on their arm and so forth, how they become an articulation of our own inner voices. And that's a really, really beautiful thing. I love the book, actually. I mean, I'll be keeping it close to me for a long time because it is kind of like a favor that you did. I mean, these are quotes that I might have like gone and collected and had to all handwrite into a journal on my own, but now I have this. So,
right. I wrote your journal for you, Melissa.
Thank you so much.
That's so sweet. I think that, that means a lot to me that you love it.
I do.
It's a pretty book too, isn't it? I mean, one of the things,
it's
from a physical standpoint, I loved that cover and the way that it's so green and gold and lovely looking.
It is. It's stunning. It truly is. So that's another pleasure about it. It's kind of, it reminds me of like green apple candy. You kind of want to lick it or something.
Exactly. has a ribbon in it, which is just to me like, you know, just to hold your place.
You have arrived.
I have a ribbon in my book.
That's right.
I have a ribbon in every book now that's a problem.
Well, okay, so one final question. I wanted to ask you, as someone who was formerly very involved with VIDA, and a feminist and a writer who has become sort of a feminist icon writer, you know, what advice would you have for women and also for other underrepresented people who are out there writing and trying to get published, just in today's world? Is there anything either about writing or about publishing?
Yeah. That's such a great question, because there are so many different answers I have to it, but I'm going to just try to give you the one that I think is maybe the most powerful, like in my life on a core level, yeah. Is that, you know, I couldn't, when I was trying to be, you know, when I was beginning my writing life, I couldn't pretend to be somebody I wasn't. Mm. You know, we talked earlier about sincerity or writing from the heart. And I remember very, very early on when I was writing, feeling like that my story wasn't worth telling. It wasn't valid. And it was because I'd grown up working class in rural Minnesota. And I just thought, you know, who wants to hear about me or the people I came from or the stories I had to tell? Like, my earliest idea of being a writer was that I needed to go off and have this sort of glamorous urban life, it was a sort of, in my imagination, sort of worthy of literature. And what I've found over and over and over again in my life is that every time I've sort of let go, again, of that kind of internalized idea of like what people want, let go of what are the valid stories, the stories that have been validated by our culture, by the powers that be in our culture. Every time I've let go of that, I've done well. I've done right. Every time I've relaxed into my own authority, by which I mean telling my story, telling the story of the people I know. This doesn't mean only write what you know, but write what's really in your, that's really authentically in you to write. Write the thing that you have to say, and trust that if you do that with intention and heart and craft, that we're going to want to hear it.
Yeah.
And I say this, you know, in my letter, Write Like a Motherfucker to Elizabeth, in my dear sugar, but I'm basically saying, you know, she says to me, well, you know, I'm so afraid nobody's going to want to read about my vagina. And the fact of the matter is nobody is going to want to read about your vagina. And nobody ever wants to read about anything. But the deal with the beautiful thing that artists throughout time have done is we've given you the stories and the songs and the images and the plays and the dances that nobody asked for. But when they got it, it felt like the truth.
Right.
And so give that. Trust yourself. Trust yourself that those stories that you have within you are worth telling. Or those images or whatever it is, whatever art you're doing. Trust that.
Thank you.
Thank you, my dear. It was fun talking to you.
It was. It was wonderful. And just, you know, thank you for your time and your incredible humanity and writing. Vida loves you.
I love Vida. Listen, I feel like we got to hang out.
I know, me too. It was wonderful.
I'm going to like pour myself a glass of wine now or something.
I know. I was kind of like, I wish we were in the room together and we could actually pull out Torch and look at some of those passages because I have it here. So anyway.
That's a lovely conversation. Yeah. And thank you. What a cool thing that Vida's doing. I really... I think it's a great, important series that you're tapping into here.
So thank you. Well, best of luck with everything, and I hope to see you in person soon.
Bye, sweetie.
Okay, bye.